On this 23rd day of May 2020, from the Lucy Coleman Studio in Los Angeles, California, in the United States of America, on God's good, great planet Earth, welcome to today's webcast. My adventures as a social poet. No, I didn't write it. Langston Hughes did, and he presented it to the Phylon Group, which was a quarterly, and the third quarter of 1947, volume number 8, section number 3. Langston Hughes presented this paper, and I'd like to read it to you. I want to try to keep it within its context. This is how I celebrate greatness from those of the African-American community. I want to turn my phone down because I really don't want to be disturbed by anyone right now today as I do this. And it's important that I don't suffer any particular interruptions as I read this. I'd like to give a candid look at Langston Hughes in 1947, his writing about those social injustices that he suffered as a black man in America. And I want you to follow along in this journey in order that we may discover something a bit more about ourselves as we listen in. Poets who write mostly about love, roses and moonlight, Langston says, sunsets and snow, must lead a very quiet life. Seldom, I imagine, does their poetry get them into difficulties. Beauty and lyricism are really related to another world, to ivory towers, to your head in the clouds, feet floating off the earth. Langston then goes on and says, unfortunately, having been born poor and also colored in Missouri, I was stuck in the mud from the beginning. Try as I might to float off into the clouds, poverty and Jim Crow would grab me by the heels, and right back on earth I would land. A third floor furnished room is the nearest thing that I ever had to an ivory tower. Some of my earliest poems were social poems that were about people's problems, whole groups of people's problems, rather than my own personal difficulties. Sometimes, though, certain aspects of my personal problems happen to also be common to many other people. And certainly, racially speaking, my own problems of adjustment to American life were the same as those of millions of others segregated Negroes. The moon belongs to everybody, but not this American earth of ours. That is perhaps why poems about the moon perturb no one. But poems about color and poverty do perturb many citizens. Social forces pull backwards or forwards, right or left, and social poems get caught in the pulling and the hauling. Sometimes the poet himself gets pulled and hauled, even hauled off to jail. I have never been in jail, but I have been detained by the Japanese police in Tokyo and by the immigration authorities in Cuba. In custody, to put it politely, due no doubt to their interest in my written words. These authorities would hardly have detained me had I been a writer about roses in the moonlight school. I have never known the police of any country to show an interest in lyric poetry as such. But when poems stopped talking about the moon and began to mention poverty, trade unions, color lines, and colonies, somebody tells the police. The history of world literature, as many examples of poets fleeing into exile to escape persecution, of poets in jail, even of poets like Placido or the recently Lorca in Spain. And please keep in mind, this piece was written in 1947. As I continue to read, Langston says, "My adventures as a social poet are mild indeed compared to the body-breaking, soul-searing experience of poets in the recent fascist countries or in the resistance poets of the Nazi-invaded lands during the war. For that reason, I can use so light a word as adventure in regard to my own skirmishes with reaction and censorship. My adventures as a social poet began in a colored church in Atlantic City shortly after my first book, The Weary Blues, was published in 1926. I had been invited to come down to the shore of Lincoln University, where I was a student, to give a program of my poems in the church. During the course of my program, I read several of my poems in the form of the Negro folk songs, including some blues poems about hard luck and hard work. As I read, I noticed a deacon approaching the pulpit. He put a note there that he placed on the rostrum beside me, but I did not stop to open the note until I finished and had acknowledged the applause of a cordial audience. The note read, "Do not read any more blues in my pulpit." It was signed by the minister. That was my first experience with censorship. Let me pause right now in the reading and say this. I can recall those days because my pastor was a man similar to that. He had certain rules, and when that pastor ruled the pulpit back in the day, you didn't step out of line because that was his church. Langston, way back, found that out. To continue to read. The kind of generous woman who sponsored my writing for a few years after my college day did not come to the point quite so directly as did the minister who disliked blues. Perhaps had it not been in the midst of the Great Depression in the late 20s or early 30s, the kind of poems that I was afraid to help bring an end to her patronage might not have been written. But it was impossible for me to travel from hungry Harlem to the lovely homes of Park Avenue without feeling in my soul the great gulf between the very poor and the very rich in our society. In those days, on the way to visit this kind lady, I would see the homeless sleeping in subways and the hungry begging in doorways on slit, strung winter days. It was then that I wrote a poem called An Ad for the Waldorf Astoria, satirizing a slick paper magazine advertisement of the opening of the deluxe hotel. Also, I wrote a poem called Park Bench. Let me read it to you, people. I live on a park bench. You? Park Avenue. Hell of a distance between us two. I beg a dime for dinner. You got a butler and a maid. But I'm walking up. Say, ain't you afraid? That I might just maybe in a year or two move on over to Park Avenue. I like that. In a little while, I did not have a patron anymore. But that year, I won a prize, the Harmon Gold Award of Literature, which consisted of a medal and $400. With the $400, I went to Haiti. On the way, I stopped in Cuba, where I was cordially invited by the writers and the artists. I had written poems about the exploitation of Cuba by the sugar barons, and I had translated many poems of Nicholas Gullion, such as Cain. Let me read this one to you. Negro in the cane fields. White man above the cane fields. Earth beneath the cane fields. Blood that flows from them. This was during the days of the dictatorial Machado regime. Perhaps someone called his attention to these poems and translations, because when I came back from Haiti weeks later, I was not allowed in the land of Cuba, but was detained by the immigration authorities at Santiago and put on an island until the American consul came after 3 days to get me off from the provision that I crossed the country to Havana in order to leave Cuba's soil at once. That was the first time being put out of any place. But since that time, I have been put out or barred from quite a number of places, all because of my poetry. Not the roses and the moonlight poems, which I write too, but because of the poems about poverty, oppression, and segregation. 9 Negro boys in Alabama were on trial for their lives when I got back from Cuba and Haiti. The famous Scottsboro rape case was in full session. I visited those boys in the death house at Kilby Prison, and I wrote many poems about them. One of these poems was one called Christ in Alabama. Listen to this, people. Christ is a nigger, beaten in black. Oh, bare your back. Mary is his mother, mammy of the South. Silence your mouth. God's his father, white master above. Grant us your love. Most holy bastard of the bleeding mouth, nigger Christ on the cross of the South. In the paper, he goes on and says, Contempo, a publication of some of the students at the University of North Carolina, published a poem on its front page on the very day that I was being presented in a program of my poems at the university in Chapel Hill. That evening, there were police outside the building in which I spoke, and in the air was a rising tension of race that is particular to the South. It had been rumored that by some of the local citizenry were saying that I should be run out of town, and that one of the sheriffs agreed, saying surely he ought to be run out. It's bad enough to call Christ the bastard, but when he calls him a nigger, he's gone too far, quote unquote. That was the sheriff. Langston goes on and writes and says, the next morning, a third of my fees was missing when I was handed my check. One of the departments of the university jointly sponsoring my program had refused to come through with its portion of the money. Nevertheless, I remember with pleasure the courtesy and kindness of many of the students and faculty at Chapel Hill and their lack of agreement with the anti-Negro sentiments of the town. There I began to learn at the University of North Carolina how hard it is to be a white liberal in the South. It was not until I had been to Russia and around the world as a writer and journalist that censorship and opposition to my poems reached the point of completely preventing me from appearing in public programs on a few occasions. It happened first in Los Angeles, shortly after my return from the Soviet Union. Now, this part of his writing really interests me because Los Angeles is my city. This is the city that I was born in 1944. But I want you to listen to this piece. Wow. As I continue to read, Langston says, I was to have been one of the several speakers on a memorial program to be held at the colored branch of the YMCA for a young Negro journalist of the community. At the behest of white higher-ups, no doubt, some reactionary Negro politicians informed the Negro YMCA that I was a communist. The secretary of the Negro branch Y then informed the community of young people in charge of the memorial that they could have their program only if I did not appear. I have never been a communist, Langston writes, but I soon learned that everyone or anyone that is visiting the Soviet Union and speaking with favor of it upon returning is liable to be labeled. Well, that's just like it is today. And let me tell you, friends, I've been labeled with a whole bunch of crap too. I love my brother Langston because he being born in the month of February like me and having a disposition very much like my own, he had to run into some roadblocks along the way. Continuing to read, indeed, when Mrs. Roosevelt, Walter White, and so Christian lady as Mrs. Bethune had never been to Moscow, but they were labeled also. I should hardly be surprised. I wasn't surprised. And the Young People Committee informed the Y secretary that since the Y was a public center, which they helped to support, they saw no reason why it should censor their memorial program to the extent of eliminating any speaker. Since I had been allotted a few moments on the program, it was my intention simply to read this short poem of mine. Now, let me read it to you. This is what he was going to read. Dear lovely death, that taketh all things under wing, never to kill, only to change into some other thing. This suffering flesh, to make it neither more or less, but not again the same, dear lovely death. Change is thy other name. I like that. But the Negro branch Y, egged by the reactionary politicians whose incomes, incidentally, were allegedly derived largely from gambling houses and other underworld activities, informed the Young People's Committee that the people would be at the door to prevent my entering the Y on the afternoon of the scheduled program. So, when the crowd gathered, the memorial was not held that Sunday. The young people simply found the audience of the situation and said that the memorial would be postponed until a place could be found where all the participants could be heard. The program was held elsewhere a few Sundays later. Man, that sounds just like today. Sounds just like some of the things that would happen today. But let me continue to read. Somebody with malice afterthought, probably the Negro politicians of Uncle Tom vintage, you see they existed back there also, gave the highly publicized California evangelist Amy Semple McPherson a copy of my poem called Goodbye Christ. Now, let me stop right here. Amy Semple McPherson was a white, evangelical, charismatic, quite out of her mind. She put on fantastic showmanship type things in her church. Angela's Temple is what they call it. It's right across the street from the lake at Echo Park in the Echo Park District. It's still there, but Amy Semple McPherson, you can read her up on YouTube and see her shenanigans. Well, she was ahead of the evangelical plots that stopped a lot of free thinkers in the day. And so when you see President Trump this week opening the churches back up in the midst of the corona crisis, you would say, what is the matter with these people? They've been insane ever since. So that's why I wanted to read this. I wanted to share with you that nothing has changed in all these years. This poem, Langston goes on and says, was one of my least successful efforts at poetic communication, in that many persons have misinterpreted it as anti-Christian, as an anti-Christian poem. I intended it to be just the opposite, satirical, even ironic in style. I meant it to be a poem against those whom I felt were misusing religion. You see, this is why Langston is a lot like myself, that they were misusing religion for worldly and profitable purposes. Now, this he wrote back in 1947, man. I was 3 years old. Wait a minute, listen to this. In the poem, Langston says, I mentioned Amy Semple McPherson. This apparently made her angry. From her Angelus Temple pulpit, she preached against me, saying, and here's a quote, there are many devils amongst us, but the most dangerous of all is the red devil. And now there comes amongst us a red devil in a black skin, quote unquote, Amy Semple McPherson. She gathered her followers together and sent them to swoop down upon me one afternoon at an unsuspecting and innocent literary luncheon in Pasadena's Vista del Arroyo Hotel. Robert Nathan, I believe, was one of the speakers, along with a number of other authors. I was to have 5 minutes on the program to read a few poems from my latest collection of folk verses, Shakespeare in Harlem. Hardly a radical book. When I arrived at the hotel, Langston says, in my car from Los Angeles, I noticed quite a crowd in the streets where the traffic seemed to be tangled. So I got out a distance from in front of the hotel and walked through the grounds to the entrance, requesting my car to return at 3 o'clock. When I asked in the lobby for the location of the luncheon, I was told to wait until the desk clerk sent for the chairman, George Palmer Putman. Mr. Putman arrived with the manager, both visibly excited. They informed me that the followers of Amy McPherson were vehemently picketing the hotel because of my appearance there. The manager added, with an aggrieved look, that he could not have such a commotion in front of his hotel. Either I would have to go, or he would have to cancel the entire luncheon. Kind of reminds me of the night that the general manager asked me not to come back to the studio. Hot tea is good for my throat. Mr. Putman put it up to me. I said that rather than inconvenience several hundred guests and a half dozen authors, I would withdraw, except that I did not know where my car had gone. So would someone be kind enough to drive me to the station? Just then a doorman came in to inform the manager that the traffic was completely blocked in front of the hotel. Frantically, the manager rushed out. About that time, a group of Foursquare gospel members poured into the lobby in uniforms and armbands and surrounded me and George Palmer Putman, demanding to know if we were Christians. Now, can you believe this? This is how fanaticism was running the church back in 1947. Before I could say anything, Mr. Putman lit into them angrily, saying that it was none of their business and stating that under our Constitution, a man could have any religion he chose, as well as freedom to express himself. Just then, an old gentleman, about 72, who was one of the organizers of the literary luncheon, came up saying that he had been asked to drive me to the station to get me out of there and so that they could start the luncheon. Shaking hands with Mr. Putman, I accompanied the old gentleman to the street. There, Amy's sound truck, because they had a sound truck with speakers all over it. You can see pictures of this thing all over the internet now, had been backed across the roadway, blocking all passages so that the limousine, trucks, and taxis were tangled up in all directions. That was a tactic that the evangelicals used. And they used it very effectively also, I might add. Continuing to read, the sound truck was playing God Bless America, while hundreds of pickets milled about with signs denouncing Langston Hughes atheistic red. Rich old ladies on the arms of their chauffeurs were trying to get through the crowd to the luncheon. Reporters were dashing out. None of the people recognized me, but in the excitement, the old gentleman could not find his car. Finally, he hailed a taxi and nervously thrust a dollar into the taxi driver's hand with the request that I should be driven to the station. He asked to be excused in order that he might get back to the luncheon. Just as I reached out the door to shake hands farewell, three large white ladies with banners rushed up to the cab. One of them screamed, "We don't shake hands with niggers where we're from," quote unquote. This is Langston Hughes giving this report. Can you believe this? Continuing to read, the thought came over me, as the picketing might turn into a race riot, in which case I did not wish to be caught in the cab and in the traffic jam alone. I did not loose the old gentleman's hand. Instead of shaking it farewell, I simply pulled him into the taxi with me, saying, "I thought that you were going to the station too." As the pickets snarled outside, I slammed the door. The driver started off. but we were caught in the traffic, blocked by the sound truck, lustily playing God Bless America. The old gentleman trembled beside me until finally we got clear of the mob. He was back down to the side of the street and turned his head to head towards the station, and the sirens of approaching police cars were heard in the distance. Later, I learned from the afternoon papers that the whole demonstration had been organized by Amy McPherson's publicity man and that the police arrived. He was arrested for refusing to give up the keys to the sound truck that stalled midway in the street to block the traffic. This simply proved the point that I tried to make in the poem, that the church might as well bid Christ goodbye if his gospel were left in the hands of such people, quote unquote. Langston Hughes, and may I say this, I agree wholeheartedly today. You can see how messed up that group of individuals are today. Langston goes on and writes, he says, for years, I was to be picketed again in Detroit by Gerald L. K. Smith's Mothers of America. For ever since the Foursquare Gospel demonstration in California, reactionary groups have copied, used, and distributed this poem. Always they have been groups like Smith's, never known to keep the fight for democratic Negro rights in America, but rather to use their energies to foment riots such as that before Detroit's Sojourner Truth's housing project, where the Klan-minded tried to prevent colored citizens from occupying government homes built for them. I had one threatening communication signed a Klansman, and many so religious anonymous anti-Negro letters from persons whose writing did not always indicate illiteracy. In other words, they wrote these ignorantly buffoon-type letters about Langston. Coming on down to the last few paragraphs, on few occasions, reactionary elements have forced liberal sponsors to cancel their plans to present me in a reading of my poems. I recall that in Gary, Indiana, some years ago, the colored teachers were threatened with the loss of their jobs if I accepted their invitation to appear at one of the public schools. In another city, a white high school principal, made apprehensive by a small group of reactionary parents, told me that he communicated with the FBI at Washington to find out if I were a member of the Communist Party. I assure him that I was not. With the approval of the school board, he presented me to the student body. To further fortify his respectability, that morning at assembly, he invited all of the Negro ministers and civic leaders of the town to sit on the stage in a semicircle behind me. To the students, it must have looked like a kind of modern minstrel show, as it was the first time any Negroes had been invited to their assembly. So goes the life of the social poet. I am sure that none of these things would ever have happened to me if I had limited my subject matter of my poems to roses and the moonlight. But unfortunately, I was born poor and colored, and almost all of the prettiest roses that I've ever have been seen are in rich people's yards, not in mine. That is why I cannot write exclusively about roses and moonlight. For sometimes, in the moonlight, my brothers see fiery crosses and a circle of clansmen hoods. Sometimes, in the moonlight, a dark body swings from a lynching tree. But for his funeral, there are no roses. That's the piece. And it was offered to the Phylon Group, which was a quarterly paper in this country written by Langston Hughes in 1947. And he called it My Adventures as a Social Poet. In other words, this is what I get for being who I am. Welcome to the world today. I hear that our president is opening the churches back up this Memorial Day weekend. And you know how black people love to go to church. And this man knows that the virus, this COVID-19, spreads rapidly amongst people in the minority communities. It's a death knell. Yeah, let them get together. Let them join in and shout and praise they Jesus together. Let them do that thing. Let them praise God. Let them meet together. So more of them, so we can spike this thing. We can get rid of more of them. I'm telling you, people, stay the hell home. Langston died in 1967, the year that I married Ana Lucia Gerenandola Soledad Monblanco. The year that I married my wife, Lucy. For 35 years, she was with me. Langston died the year that I married Lucy. I just read this piece this week, and I didn't know that he suffered at the hands of people that did not understand him. And yes, Langston, he was a gay man. I love it. I don't have a problem with that. But look at what he suffered for telling the truth. Look at what every man will suffer for telling the truth. Look at what I've suffered at the hands of the church. And what Langston suffered is no different. Because the church hasn't changed in all that time. I'm telling you, people, cut that part out of your life. I said on a recent webcast on my website, worship God on your own, love him on your own, think for yourselves. Don't attend those church services, those of you that are foolishly. And I'm telling you, listen, we don't know how this stuff is spread. If the pastor want to do something for Sunday morning, let him appear on Skype, Zoom, Facebook Live, or whatever. And let the people stay at home and watch him on the phone. Don't go there. The only person that should be in that building is one person with an engineer. And hopefully the engineer is living in the house with the man or the woman, God forbid, that is doing the talking. And I say God forbid because there's no place in the New Testament scriptures where God affirms a female as a pastor or a poem. Nowhere. Stay home this weekend. I hope that you enjoyed the reading. This is just a part of some of my adventures as a poet. Thank you for coming to my website. God bless. Enjoy the rest of the weekend, please.